T20 World Cup qualifier, European Cricket League news, and a new Nepali captain. All that and more in the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Thank you for joining us again for the Emerging Cricket Podcast online and on Sport FM in Perth. I'm Daniel Beswick and welcome to the show. First port of call tonight is the T20 World Cup qualifier, which is going on. And we have our man, Tim Cutler, over there in United Arab Emirates. And he is joined by a special guest in Bertus de Jong. So let's throw over to them now as they give their assessment of the T20 World Cup qualifier.
Sitting here with Bertus de Jong, we had the best intentions to go and watch the 5th-6th playoff between Scotland and Oman. We wandered over to the press tent, proceeded to, we didn't even get a chance to sit down in the oven of a marquee, and we've decided to retreat back to Kicker's Sports Bar into the shade, albeit still outside, to bring you this wrap and also a little bit of news about the future of the T20 World Cup qualifier. Bertus, how are you?
Well, slightly cooler than I was when we were trying to watch that cricket match before it became apparent that we could not take the heat and have thus got out of said kitchen. And yeah, no, obviously, it's a bit of a somber podcast today with events yesterday and the news coming out today. And we talk first, I guess, about the heartbreak for Hong Kong, and I'll hand over to you for that, Tim.
Thank you so much. We have our six teams, the final six to make up the 16 in the Men's T20 World Cup, Australia 2020, and that is the men from the Sultanate, Oman, who were successful in their final eliminator playoff, if we can put it that way. Hong Kong came out all guns blazing with the ball, some of the best fielding we've seen during this tournament across all teams, to have Oman reeling at 6 for 42. And then Jitinder Singh, the opening bat, played a gem of an innings, it has to be said. He batted through, I think, saw a bit of Twitter banter about whether this was carrying his bat or not, and others said it wasn't, and the innings has to be closed with the team being bowled out. But whichever way you look at it, he was 67 not out from 50 deliveries. Oman made 134 for 7, a great comeback from where they were, with some important innings at the back end. Amir Kaleem was around for a long time, making 17 off 30, and I think there were a few people thinking, well, geez, is it better him getting out here for Oman? But when he got out, Nazim Kush came out and smashed 26 from 9 deliveries to give Oman the finish they needed. They actually scored 50 from the final 3 overs. We'll talk about that a little bit further on. But in reply, the man that really needed to fire whatever Hong Kong were chasing, Nazakat Khan, was out second ball, bowled by a Bilal Khan in-swinger. Khan was, or Bilal of the Khans, quite the wrath of Khans in this match. And yes, I know I had to get that one out. Bilal was at his best, swinging ball under lights. First 3 overs, he took 3 key wickets, that of Nazakat, Azaz and Waqas Barkat. Waqas Barkat was out first ball after dismissing Azaz. He was on a hat-trick. Simadeet Singh came out on the hat-trick ball, and I think they overpitched the Yorker there, and he was able to squeeze it out for a boundary on the leg side. It was all left to Scott McKechnie again. He was elevated to number 4 in the order. He scored a great 44 off 46 balls. At one stage when he was batting with young Haroon Ashad, they were able to put on 50. It still looked like Hong Kong were in the hunt, but once Haroon got out, Ehsan Khan came out and hit 1-6, but then got out playing back to a ball that he really should have been getting forward to. It was almost a half volley drivable length from Kawa Ali, but in the end it was just too much for Hong Kong. They finished 122 for 9. Heartbreak for them. They went down by 12 runs, and after being in 2 consecutive World Cups, 2014, of course, when Hong Kong, that famous victory at Chittagong against Bangladesh, their first ever win in any form of cricket over a full member, and then 2016 in India, they are eliminated, and Oman are the 6th team. I'll just wipe a tear from my eye, Bertus, as I'm thinking about that, and pass over to you. How'd you see last night's match?
Yeah, well, we talked a bit before the game about how, Hong Kong would be the team that were happier to be in this game, and Oman maybe under the pump and coming off the back of a loss would have been somewhat demotivated, and that really looked like what we were watching for that first 10 overs, just Hong Kong outstanding in the field, and Oman looking like they were carrying on from where they'd left off with that collapse. But, I mean, what an innings from Jitinder Singh. We talked a bit about, Usman's knock and Norman Vanua and JJ Smith, but that's absolutely the knock of the tournament for me, because what he's done is he's not just seen, you know, stuck around during this collapse and then turned the tide in the last few overs in that partnership with Cushy at the death. What he's done is he's actually completely reversed the situation at the start of the match. By the innings break, it was Oman that were delighted to be there, and Hong Kong who just looked like the fire had completely gone out of them. And the way that the second innings unfolded, it almost seemed inevitable if you saw how the Omani pace attack were fired up, and Bilal Khan just unplayable, in-swinging Yorkers just nailing them ball after ball. And for me, Hong Kong were desperately unfortunate, because they ended up in their decisive game coming up against probably the best knock of the tournament and arguably the best spell of the tournament too.
We heard Scott McKechnie interviewed briefly just before the game. There was a social media snippet, and he spoke a lot about momentum. I guess it's one of those subjective topics similar to people talking about form. But in an event like this, confidence, which I would link intrinsically to momentum, is a huge thing. And that game, it just showed that a T20 game of cricket, and it's funny, we're talking to Ryan Tedeschkar walking over here, they were heading over to training and saying how at this level there really are sort of chapters and storylines within a T20 that may not happen at the highest level, with a team being six down and being able to eke out runs like Oman were. But the momentum that Hong Kong had taken into this event by coming home with their wet sail, as we've mentioned, to win three in a row, and Trent Johnston, the coach, was talking about how they'd basically won three do or die, knockout matches in those games. But to then come into this match, and they had two direct hit run outs in the power play, their young bowlers bowling well, out of their skins, up and about. You know, there was a few excited people in the press box, and I believe I was the most excited at that stage. May have dislocated a shoulder celebrating or not, I can't confirm that. One of the wickets, because it was just, this is the Hong Kong that those of us who watch them closely and see them, having played against them and with them, and the talent that they have, this is what they can do at their best. And all the way through until the 17th, well, after the 17th over was completed, I think it was 84 for 7 at that stage. Spinners had bowled well, pacers had bowled well. A wicket had fallen. Nazrul Rana had got Kaleem caught at short, fine leg off a good slower ball that he'd just brought the fine leg up that ball, bowled a slower ball. Kaleem went to scoop him and didn't make it. It straight into the waiting hands of the fielder. And that brought Cushy out to bat. And I think at that stage, all bowlers had bowled well, but Azaz Khan brought back his pace bowlers from either end. Rana had one to go. Christie had an over to go, as did Azaz. But from then on, I think it was the overs went for 17, 16 and 18. My arithmetic's probably not right there, but those 50 runs that were scored from those three overs really took away the momentum. And Oman, and as they really did like watching the bench, as you would have seen on TV, with a shot going to the Omani bench after almost every ball, which I guess that's one perspective. There was a bit of a crowd, so you would have liked to have seen some crowd perspective. But the bench went from basically being downcast and not resigned to a loss, but really, really depressed, to being up and about, fist bumping, jumping around, to the point where they were running onto the field to greet the incoming batters after the innings. And I have to say, from that point on, it was Oman's game to lose. And to see Bilal Khan come out and bowl the way he did from the first over, there's an amazing photo taken of Nazakat being bowled, and he's playing his expansive off drive, and his stumps are everywhere, his eyes are shut. I guess that standard cat, you know, hit out or get out. But from that moment on, I think momentum really was key in this game, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a degree of inevitability to it when Oman took the field after that. You know, 134 should not have been an above par score on that track, and it looked like they could have defended 100. Just at the tail end of the Oman innings, I think the way that momentum turned, to an extent you say, yeah, okay, well, like, it's one guy, it's Jatinder Singh, and coming in waiting until someone stays with him and someone can hit with him. But on the other hand, of course, there's this certainty when everything seems to be going your way that there's a risk that you think you're kind of invulnerable. And I think the way that Azaz Khan kind of stuck to sort of pre-planned approaches at the death, you know, not putting a man back out for the switch hit after Jatinder Singh had shown a remarkable, and I think almost newfound, certainly since the last time I saw him, about liking for the shot and capability of executing it. I think Hong Kong kind of didn't really react quickly enough to the way that the game was changing, and that is a risk, of course, when everything's going well. It's partly that you should always expect when one team is hugely and improbably on top, especially when they're bowling, that you would expect things to kind of revert to the mean. But we saw something more than that in those last three overs of the innings. And then, yeah, I mean, the Omani seam attack, like, we know that they can do this, especially when they have their tails up. And boy, did they have their tails up. It's a little curious, talking of momentum, though, the way that Hong Kong were able to fight their way back into that game and the way that they're sort of allowed to fight their way back into that game. Bilal Khan, of course, didn't bowl his fourth over until I think it was the penultimate over of the game. And we in the press box were quite confused, especially having seen sort of what happened with Kenya PNG earlier in a similar situation, just allowing teams back into the game. The Netherlands did it to an extent similarly against Oman of not really keeping the boot on the neck after a batting team was struggling in the power play. But impressive innings as well. Yeah, from McKechnie, he took full advantage of Oman kind of giving them a reprieve there. And at one stage, I think the game was almost very much in the balance. In the end, it wasn't going to be Hong Kong's day. And yeah, Oman, they're through to the World Cup. And we've obviously discovered today as well how important that is. We don't quite know how the groups are going to be divided as yet. Hopefully that's something we're going to look at soon. For Hong Kong, looking at the challenge leagues and looking at for want of a better word, the challenges facing Hong Kong in a way, what will Hong Kong be looking to do next?
Well, Hong Kong's next. Well, they've got a couple of tournaments coming up in pretty quick succession. They've got the ACC Emerging Nations Asia Cup. That is where all the full members put in it used to be an under 23 team with a limited number of players over age. So I think basically now it's an A-side competition. And the three associate nations in that are Hong Kong, UAE and Oman by virtue of their finishing in the top three in the Asia Cup qualifier, which feels like a long time ago now, over a year ago in 2018. Little tidbit there, last night's game was the first time that most of the Hong Kong players had played on Dubai Stadium since that almost famous game against India. And we are hearing a bit of, some whispers and scuttlebutt that the UAE will be withdrawing from the Emerging Asia Cup. That's not confirmed, but that would then bring the option of perhaps them taking the fourth placed team in the Asia Cup qualifier, which was Nepal. So a lot of people had asked why Nepal weren't in the Emerging Asia Cup because they're an ODI nation and higher ranked than both Oman and Hong Kong, but that was all based on the Asia Cup qualifier. So that would be big news for Nepal, especially with the news again. Indra Mala has been named their men's captain, and great for cricket in Nepal to be getting more quality match practice, if you call it, because they're not official ODIs. I think it is in the 50-over format. But we saw some breaking news today reported by Peter Della Penna. And I know he won't get angry at me because he's sitting across from me, but Bertus de Jong also had the same information and was waiting on a reply from a certain cricket body to get his story up for Crick Buzz. But it wasn't a secret that... Well, look, I won't talk it through. I'll pass it over to you, Bertus. You're definitely the best person to go through the news and the permutations, and we'll take it from there.
Oh, yeah, PDP. You can't beat him, can you? Yeah. He's taught me a valuable lesson today, which is publish or perish, I guess. It's disappointing for me, obviously, to be scooped by PDP so comprehensively there, but I think far more disappointing for all of us who've enjoyed this tournament, who are continuing to enjoy this tournament, that there's a very real chance that this may be the last T20 World Cup global qualifier. It's been a standout event in associates cricket. It's one of only two genuinely global associate events in the calendar. And since 2008, I think it's been my personal favourite. I've spoken before and written at length about how wonderful this format is and how great a stage it is for associate nations. It's one of the few times that associates cricket really breaks into the mainstream media as well. And what we have, as I say, what I've heard and what Peter Della Penna has also written, and I think what a few people, including Tim, may well have suspected or been aware of for some time, is that for 2021, there will not be a global qualifying event for the 2021 T20 World Cup in India, but instead they're going to... they're going to a regional final qualification system, essentially keeping the sub-regional feeding into regional finals system. But then rather than the regional finals feeding into a global qualifier, we are looking at simply one or fewer qualifying spots being allocated for each of the five ICC regions. So that's Asia, Europe, Africa, the Americas, and East Asia Pacific, with each East Asia Pacific almost certainly being combined with the logical choice would be America, but logic rarely comes into these things. Africa is also a possibility. So you'd end up now with a situation where, in spite of the ICC's commitment to having every member qualify for these tournaments, either through the rankings or through a qualification ladder, instead, the eight full members that are already in the Super 12s based on the rankings will automatically qualify for 2021. Likewise, any of the teams that make it through from the preliminary group stage, I think officially called the first round, in 2020, to the Super 12 stage, will also be guaranteed a spot in 2021, and then leaving only four spots over for the rest of the associate world, and potentially a couple of full members dropping down to regional qualifying as well. And that these spots will be decided rather than at a competitive tournament, they'll be simply allocated per region. Now, I'm sure Tim has a lot of opinions about this. I know a lot of people have been calling for a sort of regional qualification system, but if you're only having four spots allocated, you're looking at, simply a staggering competitive imbalance when you have a potential situation where, say for Europe, you could either have the Netherlands, Scotland and Ireland all dropping back to regional qualification, competing for one spot, or all three of them going through, leaving a clear run for, say, Jersey, or for Germany, or for one of the smaller European teams to come through. Whereas you compare that with, say, Asia, which is certain to be a tough group, with Nepal and UAE guaranteed there, quite possibly Oman as well dropping back, but with the potential for two full members in Bangladesh and Sri Lanka also dropping back to Asian qualifying, leaving only one spot over. I'm sure, Tim, you've got some opinions on this as well, but I think from a competitive standpoint, there's a chance that it's going to be significantly imbalanced.
Yeah, I can't say I'm surprised, to be honest. There was precious little news coming out about where certain qualifiers were going to be played and where the global qualifier would be held and how that would be done. I guess it's logical to think the news is going to come out after this event anyway. There's not much point releasing draws and future tours and qualifiers while you're still qualifying for the event beforehand unnecessarily. But yeah, as I said on the Twitterer, this event is great to filter and stress test the emerging nations as to how they go in a World Cup style tournament, while a lot of these sides will have come through regional qualifiers. They were in a single round robin and smaller events where this is longer, so fitness and other skills are tested better. And where if there was an argument that the regions weren't balanced in terms of the numbers coming through, and I know everyone will argue that Nepal should be here, as should the United States, but they didn't get through regional qualifiers, but we saw in this qualifier that the best teams have come through. I think it's fair to say that the six best teams over the course of this tournament have made it through eventually. If Hong Kong had got through, some of us would have been especially happy. But let's be honest, they beat the three bottom sides in their group, scraped in, and it would have been a surprise if they'd got through. But it pains me that we were seeing so much uncertainty about the global tournament program now, when we thought we were there, and for this now to be changed up, and then what does that mean for the future of the men's T20 World Cup pathway looking forward? But as you mentioned, with the potential jeopardy for regional teams if they all get grouped together and then falling out, and they're not able to get, if two teams don't proceed to the Super 12 from the same group, then only one of them can come back out of regional qualifying. And look, we've heard a whisper that the ICC is reconsidering that, or at least still considering it, because nothing official has come out, of course. Because you want the best teams there representing the world game, really, at the World Cup, whether it's a 16 or 20-team event, and mentioning a 20-team event, I think this would have been the perfect time. If you were pulling back on an expensive, and rightfully so, because it's the pinnacle, really, of associate cricket, of emerging cricket. If we look at it, it's a great event that really puts emerging cricket on the world stage. But if you're pulling and saving the money away from the event, rather than fanning out the funding or whatever they're doing with that money, you could make the main event bigger. Rather than the first round of eight teams going into a Super 12, why not expand it to a Russ Degnant 4x5 or something similar, Bertus?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to come back on this, there's two separate issues here, really. One of them is the new system fair? Is there a competitive balance, and is there not a risk, which I think we'll talk about a bit later? I know Nick loves this. Is there not a risk of incredibly perverse incentives, given how your route to 2021 is not only dependent on how well you do in 2020 or 2020 qualifying, but it's also very dependent on how other countries in your region do? So there's both a competitive imbalance potentially between regions. There's the potential for perverse incentives leading to really teams being in a situation where either they'd be in a better position to maybe help a country from the same region with net run rate, or they'd be in a position where they might even be best off throwing a game at the 2020 World Cup, which is, I mean, just something that just should not, under any circumstances, be an eventuality that's even possible ahead of a tournament. If the format and the implications of the final standings are properly considered ahead of time. But then there's also, and I think to my mind, this is arguably even more of an issue than the advantage or disadvantage competitively of various teams, or making it easier or harder for others to qualify, or even the possibility of perverse incentives at the tournament itself, is simply the loss of what is one of only two tournaments, really, where associates cricket has an actual chance to take a turn on the global stage and to be on TV and to break into mainstream news cycles. And I think that perhaps it's underestimated how much of an incentive and a target and a prize merely taking part in a global qualifier like this is for an awful lot of teams that are here, but an awful lot of teams that aren't here but aspire to be. That these are teams that have been told to concentrate on T20 cricket. You know, if you think about the 80 odd ICC members outside of the top 20 who maybe don't have a realistic aspiration to make it to the World Cup, certainly not so long as the World Cup, both in the 50 over and the 20 over format, are as restrictive as they are, being effectively 10 and 12 over tournaments. Sorry, 10 and 12 team tournaments. I don't think you should underestimate how much you're taking away, just a motivation from teams who target this tournament and see this tournament as an aspiration, and a chance to, you know, to play in front of, you know, to play against some of the top teams and to play in front of, you know, their fans back home that can watch them on playing on TV, and that just how much the value of this tournament is already, but certainly potentially if it was promoted properly, to drawing attention to the associate game. If you look at how regional qualifying was done, and I've said I'm a fan of the sub-regional to regional final structure. I think it works well. It's a shame nobody sees it, because it was astonishingly poorly promoted. The ICC, through their social media channels, made no effort really to draw attention to it. They were televised only, or streamed rather, only in patches and by the boards themselves. And I do not see that changing for 2021. I do not see the European finals or the Africa finals drawing a large audience or getting the attention that they would potentially deserve from the ICC or from global television audiences or from the broader media. And if you take away one of the few tournaments that at least potentially could attract that attention, then what are you asking these countries that have said 2020 is the way forward? What are you asking them to play for?
Something that gets me here as well, and just carry on from that thought of countries being told to concentrate, is that there was a lot of talk about it going the completely opposite direction and actually making full members all qualify through regional qualifiers. And yes, there are time pressures here that mean that we've only got a year until the next event, but that could then lend itself to perhaps having mega regional qualifiers, or at least larger ones, feeding into a global event that are very much part of the pathway and are marketed and are broadcast correctly. We go back to this event and, you know, Zimbabwe should have been here, I mean, on a rankings point of view, and they would have changed the groups up differently. They would have come in as one of the top seeds, and when Nigeria had come in at the bottom, it would have meant we had a different makeup in the groups, and that would have raised the profile, and also the skill level out there. And if Nepal and the USA had got their acts together in the regional qualifiers, it's been a great event anyway, I'm not taking away, but this is a really, really good cricket. And to be going the complete opposite way, as you say, that the regional and sub-regionals hadn't been marketed the way that they could be, and it couldn't be that hard to have the likes of a 3-4-5 camera stream with commentators such as Andrew Leonard and whatnot there anchoring it, who are knowledgeable about the teams out there and also broadcast professionals. I don't think it's rocket science really here for us to use T20 as the vanguard of the game's growth, which has been attested to by the ICC themselves. So the way that this has been done, it is really a head scratcher. And we've had a few head scratching moments in the last few weeks with a few things going on. And the response may well be, well, it's only this time because we only have a year until the next T20 World Cup, and we'll all go back to sub-regional and perhaps even the mega regional qualifiers. But unfortunately, as we've seen, when things change like this, I'm not sure the analogy is correct, but with airline tickets having inclusions taken away and never being given back, my theory for the game is once this regional structure, which was just moving in the right direction, is changed and taken away, we may never get it back again.
Howard, it's the old adage, of course, if you're working in a bureaucracy, you best make up your annual budget. You better spend your entire annual budget, because otherwise it's getting chopped next time. And we should maybe row back a little bit. We've spoken perhaps a little in anger and disappointment at the loss of this tournament for 2021. There are time pressures. They have taken the decision to run two back-to-back T20 World Cups in the space of less than a year. The idea, then naturally, this is obviously going to put a squeeze on budgets for global events, for pathway events especially, asking them to double up. So from certain perspective, there is an understandable decision that you have to find those savings somewhere. But the risk is that, if you run a qualification system on the cheap, there is every chance, especially the financial pressure that the ICC are under with, you know, the BCCI, who, and in fairness to the BCCI, of course, they are under their own domestic pressures, and certainly from both the press and from state associations to stand up for themselves, as it's so often presented in the Indian media. And stand up for themselves seems to mean getting as much cash out of the ICC as possible, with little consideration for the implications for the global game. The BCCI are not in an easy position, but they put the ICC in a squeeze as well, and that squeeze inevitably transfers to the associates and to these kind of competitions. Going forward, grander regional events, it seems to me just like a line. I just can't see it happening. I can't see, given the incentive structures within the institution of the ICC and the way that you know, full member boards' interests are aligned, I simply can't see that coming out of it. So I don't mean to be too down on the ICC. I understand that they, of course, have their own difficulties to deal with. But the way I think that all these, the stars are just very poorly aligned in institution theoretic terms.
Well, thank you for listening to another special edition from Dubai. I'm Tim Cutler, and I'm here with Bertus de Jong of CricBuzz, well, numerous news agencies, signing off.
Thanks a lot to Tim Cutler out there in UAE, as well as Bertus de Jong of CricBuzz, joining Tim to discuss all things T20 World Cup qualifier, as well as the potential scrapping of the tournament, and it's something that I want to talk to you about, Nick, because it's a huge topic and a huge story that has broken at a weird time, really, because just when this tournament is starting to heat up in terms of finding a winner of it. I know that the qualifiers have already been determined, but it's a strange decision at a strange time, and it seems for the ICC and for world cricket, it's two steps forward and two steps back.
Yeah, gee, it's disappointing, isn't it? I mean, even just from a personal level, we were talking a bit earlier that, you know, if we'd known that this was going to be the last one, we would have obviously made a lot more of an effort to get there and to watch it, because these tournaments are amazing. And that's the thing. It's such a good tournament. It's I think, probably the ICC's second best tournament. And that's after the Intercontinental Cup, which has also largely disappeared off the radar for the moment. So, yeah, they have these great tournaments, and they just keep messing around with them. And you know, it looked like we finally had some stability with the sub-regional qualifying and the regional finals and the global final, and that, you know, everyone qualifies on merit. You know, it was a really good structure, and I think most of us here on the podcast and in, you know, associate cricket world were pretty happy with it. And even speaking to teams, and they all thought it was good too. So to suddenly move away from that, and yeah, it is just disappointing, because this whole event, let's not forget, it made a profit for the ICC as well last time. So it's not like it's a dead weight on their revenue either. So it's just a pretty strange decision all up. And I don't know, thinking about the way the tournament looks, and you know, they already have the first round, so-called, that sort of acts as another qualifier. If you're going to go down that path, why not just have the main qualifier before the main event, and then just do away with the first round? There's a lot of things going on here that don't really make sense. Why are they having two T20 World Cups within 12 months? And then it seems like my suspicion is that the dev team, the development arm of the ICC, kind of they came up with the new structure and the new pathways and sort of got that all organized and lined up, and then, you know, higher up the chain, somebody made the decision to, you know, scrap the Champions Trophy and turn it into a T20 World Cup. And so that sort of threw out a lot of their plans. And obviously they've had a time squeeze, because the turnaround on getting the sub-regionals and the regional finals and the global final and getting all that done by next year in time for the next event is going to be tough. Yeah, so as I said, it's just really disappointing, because it's a great tournament, and it provides great quality cricket. And this is the thing. This is the ICC's product, is international cricket and high quality, high stakes international cricket. And this tournament delivers that, and to be cutting it, it's just bizarre, really.
Well, it is baffling, and I've spoken to people who watch this tournament as fans of cricket who are not as up to date or as savvy on associate cricketers in the emerging game, and they've all loved this tournament. As you said, that the last qualifier made a profit. I dare say this tournament will do decently well, without knowing the ins and outs too much of that. But you're right, the qualifying pathway for these teams is a nice story. I mean, if you look at Bermuda, they started their qualifying campaign in Argentina and then qualified at home through the regional qualifiers there, and then played in a tournament in UAE. Granted, they weren't very good at that particular tournament, but it's a great story and it's a great pathway for these teams. And it gives every single member, or every single participating member, a chance to qualify. You know, if we do go down this route of amalgamating two regions, and it puts a lot of teams in a difficult spot to continue on their path to qualify for global tournaments like this. But hopefully a rethink is in order, because the ICC development team do an amazing job. And for the ICC's higher echelons, this is one of the best tournaments they have. And for them to get rid of it shows potentially a lack of, you know, knowing or feeling the room, having no awareness of what people want, because the viewership is good. You know, we're watching games here in Australia. It's on Fox Sports. It's on many of the channels around the world who are profiling these teams and giving them, you know, the exposure. This is the window to emerging cricket for new fans into the emerging game. So we need competitions like, and that's why it's so disappointing. Nick, we'll move on. I want to talk about Gyanendra Mallah being appointed as the new Nepali senior men's national team captain. It was announced yesterday by the Cricket Association of Nepal in a statement. It was their second meeting since their reinstatement by the ICC that actually offered Paris Khadka a chance to reinstate himself as the captaincy. He turned that down. That was in the first meeting. So they adjourned the captaincy discussion on the agenda for the second meeting and have appointed Gyanendra Mallah. Mallah is one of the senior members of the batting lineup for the Nepalis. He made his senior debut in the early to mid 2000s. So he has been a part of the setup for a long time. He's obviously come through the junior setup as well. But Nick, it was a pretty logical decision based on our conversation in previous podcasts about batsmen being captains. But given that he actually took a leave of absence for the Singapore Tri Series and the Oman Pentangular Series, he comes back into the side and is given the captaincy.
Well, it was one of those questions, and we did sort of speculate on this, you know, who's nailed down in this side? And, I mean, I'm not 100% sure that, you know, Mallah would have been nailed down in this side coming into this decision, because, you know, he has struggled a bit of late with the bat, and it looks like they were sort of experimenting with some new faces in the lineup. And, yeah, so it's an interesting call to bring it back. But, yeah, I guess, again, he is one of the few senior players still around the team who's, you know, been around that for that long, so it makes sense in one respect, and it's also a bit, you know, I guess it guarantees his selection for the next little while, and well, hopefully he can turn around his form, because yeah, he has been struggling. Did he captain any teams in the EPL that you saw? Because I remember you kept a bit of an eye on that.
So he was the captain of the Lalitpur Patriots, which did include Sandeep Lamachani, so he does have captaincy experience, and I do know that he has filled in the captaincy role when Paris Khadka has been unavailable or injured for whatever reason. He's still only 29, which is interesting because he has been around the senior setup for a long time, since 2006, I believe. So for him to come in and be the leader for potentially the next 5 years, and I think the heir apparent afterwards would be someone like Dipendra Singh Iyer. And it looks like a good decision, and perhaps it might give him a little bit of security batting-wise, because I think at the top of the order, a lot of Nepalis actually struggle at the top of the order, and they actually think that their spot's on the line. And for him to know that he is in the team and he is keeping, it could well be the best thing for him. And they've got MCC touring there next week, which is his first assignment as captain, and we'll hopefully have some news on that when it comes to hand. But look, at this stage, I think it's a little bit of a stopgap because, you know, how can one replace possibly the greatest Nepali cricketer of all time and be thrusted in that position knowing that you're going to get the incumbent solidified leader of a cricket team? I think the jury will be out, and I think there'll be heavy scrutiny. We all know what the Nepali fan base is like. As passionate as it is, it's also quite harsh at times. But a lot of them will get behind Gyanendra, and hopefully for his sake, he can provide some good performances on the field, not only with the bat, but with his field placements and his bowling changes as well.
Yeah, looking forward to that MCC series, actually. And they're playing a three-day game, which has been awarded first-class status, which I think is fantastic. And it's the first time they've played a first-class game against an associate team on one of their tours for years and years and years. I think I saw it was in the late 90s or early 2000s, before Bangladesh got their full membership. They played a first-class game. And it just shows, you know, there is that desire and appetite for multi-day cricket in Nepal. And I guess in a world of associate cricket where multi-day cricket, we don't really know where it fits into the plans, you know, with the, as I mentioned, the I Cup being sort of in limbo and we don't really know what's going on. So I think, you know, Nepal is turning up to watch a three-day game of multi-day cricket, you know, red ball cricket, showing that there is just, there is an appetite for that format. I think that'll be just fantastic to see. And hopefully, we see more multi-day cricket involving associates going forward.
And we'll have coverage of that MCC match in the next show. Let's move on to some news coming out of India, which is not a country you would associate with emerging cricket, but it does relate to Anshuman Rath, who, of course, ex-Hong Kong. And we saw Hong Kong unfortunately bow out of the qualifier agonisingly short. Anshuman Rath has been signed by Vidarbha for the Indian summer of domestic cricket. Now, he needed to be signed up now before the qualifier had started, hence why he pulled out of the Hong Kong team to be classified as a local player for the IPL for next year. As a Hong Kong representative and now pushing through Indian cricket, how do you see this going, and can he get through that large conveyor belt of Indian talent to get to some elite four-member cricket?
Yeah, as I said, when it was announced, I think he's got a good chance. He's a very, very good player. And as we've seen, the Indian lineup at times can be a bit choppy, and they do experiment a lot. So there'll be openings at times. So if he puts together a run of form, I can definitely see him being in contention. And I guess the other thing is, yeah, that IPL draft and playing as local, that's going to be huge for him if he does get picked up. And, I mean, honestly, if you don't pick him up, IPL teams, you've got rocks in your head because he's a fantastic player. But having a guy like Anchi Rath, and Russell Degnan sort of touched on this when he was on the pod, but, you know, having guys go from associate nations to full member nations to pursue their career, it's good for them, obviously, but it's bad for cricket overall because it means that the quality is leaving the associate world and strengthening the full member teams who are already strong rather than, you know, helping associate cricket raise the standard overall. So it is disappointing that the players need to do that, I guess, to make make ends meet out with cricket. So yeah, I feel a bit conflicted, I guess, that, like, I'm wishing him all the best and I'm glad that he's been signed, and I think it's a fantastic story for him, but it is a bit disappointing for associate cricket in general that, you know, we don't get to see him playing in these tournaments. And, you know, who knows, you know, Hong Kong missed out on qualifying for the World Cup by 12 runs in the end, and that's, you know, Anchi Rath could have made all the difference.
And when you think about when Hong Kong played India last, Anchi Rath as well as Nazakat Khan put on that partnership at the start of the Hong Kong innings to get them so, so close to beating India. So Anchi showed the quality on that day, and hopefully that is fresh in the memory banks of Indian selectors and people who do watch Indian domestic cricket. And we wish him all the best here at Emerging Cricket. Let's move on to the European Cricket League, which has announced some news this week. We've seen two new national members join the European Cricket League in Norway and Sweden, two Scandinavian countries, of course. And with some extra news, it's been announced this week that due to the Dutch having the champions of the ECL in VOC Rotterdam, it means that due to their automatic entry for next year, it means that another team will take up the Dutch spot, which will go to HBS. So already three new teams in an expanded tournament, which will go for a week next year. Those dates are the 31st of May to the 7th of June. Nick, we haven't got the confirmed number as yet as to how big this tournament is expanding to, but you have to say, to Daniel Weston and his team, they've done a marvellous job in developing the game, or at least providing a platform for the development of cricket in Europe to build. And they're doing it through domestic clubs with long histories in countries that have seen cricket being played in their respective countries for decades, if not hundreds of years, or at least 100 years plus.
Yeah, and I guess it goes to that point we were just making with Anchi, and, you know, the fact that you can't make a living as an associate player out of the game and you have to move to a full member nation a lot of the time, and that's what Daniel Weston is trying to do, is trying to give a platform to these guys and you know, ultimately 10-20 years down the track have a competition that, you know, people can actually make some money out of. And so yeah, I think it's a great concept. We've talked about it a lot, and it was a lot of fun watching it happen in the T10 format down in Spain. I think, you know, having new teams is always good, and it's interesting to see that Dan Weston and co leaning into expansion, just as it seems like the ICC is they're cutting another tournament. And yeah, so contrast couldn't be starker. But yeah, so it'll be great to see some more new faces and some more clubs. And as we've said before, the idea of tying it in with local clubs and building from local clubs rather than, for example, the T20 Slam franchises being dropped in from the top. Yeah, I like this approach a lot more.
Yeah, and it builds off the history that these clubs have already built in their time as cricket clubs over the years. It's not a cookie cutter situation where we have franchises made on the spot, but we have quite a contrast across the countries by way of how long cricket has been involved in. In certain countries, we know the history of the Dutch and the Danish, and now we see the boom of Germany, and Daniel Weston's actually been a huge part of that through German Cricket TV and his team there. But for the European Cricket League to be broadcast in over 100 countries shows that there is a potential to expose in a worldwide market, and with the high quality of production and cameras and everything like that, it shows people like the ICC that this can be done, as we see streams pop up for Cricket World Cup League 2 now. Hopefully, it sends a strong message to people involved in cricket administration that things are possible if you do have the right people involved and you have the right ways of going about things. So we do look forward to that competition next year. Another series that we are looking forward to is a Uganda tour to Zimbabwe, which is being used as a build-up tour ahead of the Cricket World Cup Challenge League. And this is a good opportunity for Uganda to play Zimbabwe, play a neighbour of theirs, which does help in terms of logistical costs, but it also gives them a great opportunity to build their team for a leg of the Challenge League that they could well be close to favourites in.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they are preparing in Zimbabwe. Obviously, the geographical proximity is probably one of the factors there, but we saw Scotland prepare in South Africa ahead of this T20 World Cup qualifier that's just been happening, and there was a bit of chat about whether, you know, that was the best lead up for the conditions, and you know, the fact that the Challenge League's being held in Oman rather than Hong Kong. Yeah, I don't know how that'll prepare them, but yeah, good, and it's good for Zimbabwe as well to see, you know, to get them playing a bit more against associates in the region. And yeah, they've had a pretty rough time of it with the suspension and whatnot of late. So just the fact that they're going to have some more games there as well, or as probably not going to be the full Zimbabwean team, but I think Zimbabwe, after all the turmoil that they've had with the suspension, playing more against local associates rather than full member teams is going to help them as well, because you know, the quality is just getting better, and having those relationships, reciprocal relationships, means that they're going to have, you know, more teams that they're able to play against, and that's one of the things with growing the game everywhere, is just the more teams you have to play against, you know, the more options you have in terms of teams that can tour and people potentially watching your game. So I think this is a good move by Uganda, and hopefully they do well against the Zimbabwean sides they do play.
Their first Challenge League leg, they're in Group B of the Challenge League, is to be hosted in Oman from the 2nd to the 12th of December. Looking forward to that, and of course we'll provide all the coverage you need in regards to that on emergingcricket.com. To stay on Oman, of course they were the 16th qualifier for the T20 Cricket World Cup. Their under-16s have enjoyed some success, beating UAE in a thrilling final of the Asian Cricket Council Western Region under-16s tournament. They won by a wicket, chasing a target of just 89, a 35-over structure that they went with. It was dominated, this competition, by the two that did make the final in UAE and Oman. Bahrain and Kuwait had two wins each in Group A and Group B, respectively. The same can be said about Saudi Arabia and Qatar in Group A and B, respectively, with one win each. And Iran and the Maldives both winless in their groups. Nick, this tournament did go the direction we thought it would, but there seems to be an added rivalry here between UAE and Oman now, and hopefully, given UAE's controversy aside across the last week or so, that there is a rivalry building in that Middle Eastern region between the two sides.
Yeah, this whole, the Gulf region, obviously, you know, Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar as well playing there. Having these teams increasing in quality is very good, I think, for the game, and for the fact that, I guess, having more teams, as I was saying before, having more teams being competitive is always good. UAE and Oman did completely dominate their groups. You know, I can see UAE went through with a net run rate of 7.5, which is just unbelievable. I think the rivalry between the UAE and Oman is interesting, because you know, you look back even 5 years and Oman were definitely lagging behind, but now, you know, as we saw with the senior sides, obviously the UAE were in turmoil, but Oman qualified and UAE didn't, and here they've had the Red Brigade, as Oman's called. They've won the underage tournament as well. I think we're seeing Oman on the way up, and having some more competition in that region is going to be good for UAE, and that'll push them as well. And you know, just thinking back to sort of 5-10 years ago in the associate world, when we had Afghanistan and Ireland as the two leading teams, and they were constantly pushing each other to get better, and so that's why I always like to see these rivalries developing, and having a couple of teams that sort of spur each other on to get better, it's always going to be good, because it means that it just increased the standard massively.
And once again, congratulations to Oman for taking that tournament out. Commiserations to UAE, and hopefully a few of the players that shone here at this tournament we may well see under some brighter lights in years to come. Nick, I think that's just about all that we have time for today. Thank you for joining me in our abbreviated chat with Tim on the ground in UAE.
No worries, Bez. Great to take the limelight for a change, eh?
Oh, don't be like that. You know, you get enough of the enough of the airtime with your responses. To keep up with news from cricket's new world, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platform, and make sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening to the podcasts and whichever of the 80-plus countries you're listening to it in. For now, from myself, Daniel Beswick, and the boys, Tim Cutler, Nick Skinner, and Bertus Young, who joined us tonight, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.